This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up...
The pair are bringing their design to indigenous and protected lands and have tapped into a need for low-budget, big-impact projects outside Brazil's major cities.
Political turmoil is nothing new in Brazil, and the inauguration earlier this January of the far-right president Jair Bolsonaro has done little to soothe tensions, not least his plans to lift regulations that protect the rainforest and pass control over to pro-business interests. We meet the Sao Paulo architects building a different future in the Amazon. Plus,
we actually wanted to be open and inviting.
We pore over the studio cum cafe of a Copenhagen architecture firm to ask if seeing is believing. And we're joined by our technology correspondent, who's back from the Consumer Electronics Show, Joy of Joys, in Las Vegas, to tell us what's on his radar for 2019. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24, with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Brazil's Bolsonaro president was sworn in earlier this January, and he spent much of his time swaggering around and discussing the fate of protected areas of the Amazon rainforest. One of his first executive orders stripped a government body of its power to establish indigenous reserves and awarded the power instead to the Agriculture Ministry, a division that's already overseen massive deforestation in the name of private interests. So how can Brazil's indigenous people fight back? Well, there are the expanded road networks that respect the forests and a sense of fostering responsible tourism, but architects are also playing a part in developing Brazil's inland infrastructure. Monocle's Latin America affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott spoke to the firm Aleph Zero, which has designs on helping the Amazon, from Sao Paulo.
You're going to build in the Amazon? That's a common question put to the two leading architects at Aleph Zero, a little-known Brazilian firm that made a big name for themselves last year by being presented with one of architecture's most prestigious awards, the Royal Institute of British Architects Prize for International Excellence. Gustavo and Pedro beat competitors with a eucalyptus timber-beamed children's village in the remote town of Formosa do Araguaia, high up in the northern state of Tocantins, on the edge of a protected area of forest. The winning entry was a boarding house for roughly 800 students and staff who must sleep over because they have too far to travel in every day. A simple yet impressive design, with a vast canopy on top of tall wooden pillars and mud brick shelters that cover a neatly crafted set of bedrooms, reading spaces and play areas. Originally from the smaller Brazilian city of Curitiba, the pair are bringing their design to indigenous and protected lands and have tapped into a need for low-budget, big-impact projects outside Brazil's major cities that are both environmentally and economically sustainable. We paid them a visit in São Paulo's leafy neighbourhood of Pinheiros, where they've just returned from a trip to the remote Amazon rainforest to unveil their latest project, a series of community centres to serve a tribe inside the vast protected indigenous Xingu Park. Hi.
Hi.
It's important to understand the distance to the site. For example, for me to arrive in the community, it took 24 hours. So it's really far away and it's really complicated to get inside of it and know the community, of course, too. So the distance is really important to the project. So that's why we use always local material and try to exchange knowledge how to build it, because they build really beautiful, that we call ocas, that they are amazing, that this knowledge that they carry for so long. So what we try to do is not compete with that. We try to do something different. With this contradiction, we think that we can show that what they do, it's really interesting. And we didn't try to compete with them. So in this way, we put our building a little bit far away from the center of the community, because the center of the community is not the building, it's the community itself.
Designed almost like a flat pack in eight different pieces, the format of the first new center in the eastern part of the park can be rearranged and dismantled to suit the community's needs. The space, commissioned by a government body, the Amazon Foundation, serves to promote the culture of the Kisijé peoples and includes two large halls, cooking facilities, and an area to sell what they make.
The project is really simple. It's most like a roof because it's so hot and rains a lot sometimes. So the project is just a roof that we can accommodate different functions inside of it. And we built it using mostly local materials, just like the roof is made from metal sheet that is thermal insulation, but everything else is like wood from the local community and bricks. The indigenous community always changing location, so we put all the pieces together with screws so we can like put it together and assemble and disassemble it again, so they can move this project as they wish.
Jair Bolsonaro, a right-wing retired military officer, took over on New Year's Day. He has expressed extreme scepticism that indigenous people would actually choose to remain in protected areas of the Amazon rainforest and other unspoilt regions of Brazil, saying that they're being kept in zoos. Ahead of his victory, he said in 2017 that they wanted electricity, television, blonde girlfriends, and internet.
Se eu chegar lá, no que depender de mim, todo cidadão vai ter uma arma de fogo dentro de casa. Não vai ter um centímetro demarcado para reserva indígena ou para quilombola.
Pedro, at a Left Zero, explained how there's no air conditioning in their new designs in this part of the country. They've had to think carefully about what styles to apply, moving away from the solid concrete slabs caked in white paint that have become emblematic of modern Brazilian architecture.
Some styles of Brazilian architecture were also very interesting, but they were maybe more directed into solving more specific problems of the city, and therefore the solutions were also very tied to this means of production of the city, of the new growing, the means of concrete and steel, and even the forms of how to build the city. And so there was maybe an opportunity there that you could still look at again in a way of discussing some of the things that were discussed before, looking again outside of the city or on these other populations that live in a different, very different climate from what we have. Modernity was very productive in creating a lot of space in a short amount of time.
Under Bolsonaro's administration, the business-minded agriculture ministry will be in charge of establishing indigenous reserves, a job previously given to the Funai Protection Agency and the Ministry of Justice. The presidential decree, which will expire in about 4 months unless ratified by Congress, has alarmed environmentalists, who fear that downgrading the Funai agency is a prelude to the total destruction of indigenous lands. The firm, however, holds on to hope for future design.
We hope that this building helped the community to first to establish a better connection with white people, if I can say that, because it's a place that they can receive tourism and everything, so to make it easier for us to understand their culture. So this is an important thing. And the other thing maybe is how can we deliver great architecture to these people, right? Because they usually are outside of the national concerns.
Integration of these communities in 2019 may be inevitable, but getting firms to design there is another challenge they want to address.
We have like a huge demand to do this kind of architecture in the Amazon. But the point is, if the architects are interested in getting engaged in this situation, because to work in these situations, you're not in your comfort zone, right? Because you need to understand better the place and everything, it's really complicated.
You have less control than you're used to.
This project that we did in Xingu, we cannot communicate it with the construction site. So when you go there for the first time, you need to teach who will construct. So we need to trust them that they will deliver the best that they can.
And what they've so far managed to deliver in the distant rainforest is truly spectacular. For Monocle in São Paulo, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Oh. Our sincere thanks to Monocle's Lucinda Elliott, reporting there from Sao Paulo. Now, it's always a dangerous game to make too many predictions, and the speed at which the technology industry is moving makes it all the more foolhardy. But there exists one shining place to glimpse progress, and that is the Consumer Electronics Show hosted in Las Vegas, which wound down last week. David Phelan is Monocle's technology correspondent. He was in attendance and he joined Tom Edwards to discuss what the former was looking forward to in 2019.
I think the thing about design and technology is that it is, in good design, it is absolutely hand in glove with the technology itself. So this year we're going to see 5G networks taking off. And that means phenomenal speed, no latency, all those things that are promised and may or may not be delivered. But they require a different chipset and a different kind of battery quality. So we may find phones getting bigger rather than getting smaller, but there's a current design obsession with an all-screen. People who have an iPhone 10 or above know that there's a notch taken out of it where the camera sits. In the next few months, we will see phones which have much, much smaller notches, or even a hole-punch design, as they call it, which Honor is about to come up with, and Samsung. And that means you can have the rest of the phone covered in screen, providing you can do something with the fingerprint sensor. So you either put it on the back, or in the case of some of the very latest phones, you put it in the screen itself. So I think the key thing about design in mobile phones is a move towards having no design at all, almost, so that it is just screen. You just are immersed in the pixels.
And I wonder, David, two prongs to this question, really. Is that largely aesthetic in terms of the design driver, or is it about function? And secondly, do improvements in the design enable technological leap forwards, or is it absolutely the other way around and you have to sort of wait for the technology to afford the designers the opportunity to make big changes?
I think, again, they go hand in glove. It's the desire for the aesthetic which has led to the smaller and smaller gaps in the screen. But there is also a desire to be innovative. So, for example, at CES last week, there was a rollable television that flat, slides down, slides up in and out of a box. And that's made possible because OLEDs are by nature flexible. And if you can get the backing flexible as well, then you can do much with it. And so also at CES, there was a foldable phone from a company called Royole. And it's a very peculiar thing. Samsung are going to follow up with something similar in a month or two. And essentially, it looks like a phone, but you fold it out and actually the screen goes across the back as well. And it folds up and it's thick and it looks like a newspaper. And that's a problem that hasn't yet been solved. And you've still got to get the battery in as well. But it's an example of how, again, technology and design fit together well.
And in terms of mobile telephony, are we at a point where, sure, there may be foldable phones, there could be slider phones where some of that functionality described, the cameras, for example, emerge from behind?
Yes.
Or are we at the point where, ultimately, I don't know whether just because of ubiquitousness of design, you know, the thing that will continue to be the norm is that single screen. Maybe it's the whole handset. But I don't know, the mood isn't right amongst the public to make a big shift to a folding phone or a sliding thing. I mean, or is it the classic thing where people want to see the performance, and if that's better for whatever reason, then they'll make even quite a big change?
Yes, I think that's true. I think the folding phone at this stage is certainly just a gimmick. That's all it is. Whereas when the iPhone was launched, no one accused that of being a gimmick because you could see the value in having a good screen with a good touch screen. But I think there's also, and this strays into the world of smart home, there's also an important connection between design and other values, such as, for example, privacy. Mm-hmm. So that gadgets that have microphones and cameras on them are now not quite trusted. There have been issues with Amazon Echo. There's another Amazon brand, the Ring Video Doorbell. Just in the last few days, it's been announced that lots of staff at Ring had access to the video feeds from these doorbells, many of whom, it's alleged, did not have any need to see these who were standing at people's doors. And the thing is that that is already beginning to have an effect. The Google Home Hub, the latest virtual personal assistant box from Google, has a screen on it, but deliberately doesn't have a camera because they recognize that people see that as a step too far in terms of privacy.
Well, it's interesting you lead us on to that, David. And I did want to talk more about the Internet of Things, this bigger picture of connectivity. What role does design play? I mean, clearly it can address concerns people have about privacy in terms of whether something has a camera or not, what it sees, what it can hear. Is the design question, though, for 2019 and maybe further ahead about refining existing technologies? Is design, again, going to be a driver for the innovation? Or again, is it all this question of the two hand in glove, as with mobile phones?
I think it's slightly different with smart home because it needs to fit in with your decor in the way that a phone doesn't. You can choose a case or whatever if you want to customize it. But, and we've seen this with the latest versions of the Amazon Echo come in different colors, different cloth finishes. And it's a much more difficult thing to get right, in a sense, because it's got to be, for example, the Apple HomePod smart speaker has got, again, a cloth covering, and you can choose between grey or white. That's all that Apple does, and that would fit with a lot of decors, but it's got to be warm and inviting in the way that something that sits in your living room would want to be, but it's still also got to be technologically capable, and that's quite a tightrope to walk.
Dave, just on sort of a pure design question, you know, you spend a lot of time talking to a number of leaders in this field. They're obviously fascinated by design, whether it's, you know, the function of industrial design, but they are interested in aesthetics as well. Are those things sometimes in conflict? Because I guess people maybe don't look to cutting-edge technology for examples or exemplars of traditional design beauty in the same way that they might with a different physical product, whether it's, you know, a household item or clothing or whatever it might be. How does that conversation happen? Is it one of conflict? Is it one of balance? Do you think that there's enough consideration given to pure aesthetic for its own sake? Or can these companies not afford, in any manner of speaking, to worry about it in quite the same way as, say, someone who's making, I don't know, products, industrial design companies, for example?
I think the key word in what you just said was afford. I think that if you are a company that has the resources, you'll come up with better design. And an obvious example would be Apple. I interviewed Johnny Ive just a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how the screens on the latest iPad Pro and on the latest Apple Watch, they don't have square corners to the displays. They now have rounded corners because he says, you know, they're sympathetic to the rounded shape outside them. And it does make a very striking difference to the intimacy of those products. And I think that there are many cases where designers would love to do something as clever as that, but that costs extra money. To have a rounded display, it costs a lot more than... And obviously, it's not just in the glass or the screen. It's also the coders have to use anti-aliasing to make it look like it's curved when it's not. And that kind of level of detail, which is the heart of good design, isn't available to every company.
Many thanks to Monocle's David Phelan, speaking to Tom Edwards there. Designers and architects don't always get their way. Often the buildings and products we see around us are the result of compromise, various iterations, and, dare I say it, tight briefs from bill-paying clients. So what happens when an architecture practice sets its own brief? Well, this was the case for Copenhagen firm Kobe, which decided to extend its own office in the Danish capital to include a cafe. The result is a triumph for several reasons. Not only has the team left the door ajar for the curious and the coffee-hungry, it's also created some goodwill in the community and a pleasant space for its own workers. Cleverly, Kobe has also allowed potential clients to experience its work firsthand and coffee in hand. Here's reporter Gabriele Delisanti in Copenhagen.
I'm in northern Copenhagen on a crisp winter's day by a desolate street surrounded by water, construction sites and brick warehouses, as well as some of the country's most luxurious apartments. This is the district of Nordhavn, Danish for Northern Harbour, what used to be a bare industrial port and now an emerging neighbourhood, home to some of Denmark's leading architecture firms and design studios. Located by the Silo, an eye-catching, futuristic apartment complex, architecture firm Kobe is based in one of their area's renovated warehouses, where ceilings are high and glass walls abundant. Founded in 2005, Kobe now employs over 100 architects and is behind a number of award-winning projects around Denmark, from libraries to train stations, museums, and, more recently, a cafe right at the entrance to their office. A first of its kind, it offers locals a space to relax and enjoy a cup of coffee, while giving curious architecture aficionados a peek into Cobb's busy practice. The aim? To redefine the relationship between the architectural practice and the public. The cafe is spacious, with long white lamps hanging from the ceilings, while models of Cobb's buildings stand on the left and images of their projects are lined on its walls. It's here that I meet Cobb's founder and creative director, Dan Stubegård, to understand the concept behind what isn't just Copenhagen's latest hygge spot. He tells me a little bit more about how the idea of opening a cafe in their studios came about, and their aim to drop a corporate environment in favor of a relaxed, welcoming, and meticulously designed space.
It's a little bit a cafe, but also a little bit of architectural gallery as well, and entrance to Kobe. We decided to take part of this neighborhood by moving here and moving our office here. And then my idea was actually not to think an office and an architectural studio in the traditional way. We actually wanted to be open and inviting. And the tool of being that is created by this cafe we recently opened, which is this kind of a informal space where we invite people into our office, but also where we can create dialogue with the people living here in the North Harbor, but in general, people from the city or visiting the city as well. So it's a little bit a way of embracing the city and actually inviting people into our architectural office. You know, our architectural studio is very much like these kind of nicely black-dressed architects sitting. It's super quiet and it's super serious business. And we wanted to step out of that more kind of corporate atmosphere and be an open, inviting place where we create dialogues. We are going to have a lot of events in the cafe and basically just inviting people in so they can get a bit of the atmosphere in our office as well.
In explaining how Cobb plans on opening to the public, Dan tells me how the cafe will go beyond lattes and croissants by hosting talks, parties, and serving as what he defines as an urban living room, showcasing Cobb's contribution to the development of the local area.
We also want to show, for instance, what we are doing here in the North Harbor, like showing different models we are doing. I think we are having six buildings emerging here in this area. So the whole neighborhood is a little bit our laboratory for urban experiments in one-to-one. And we want to show that and show our thinking through meeting people in the cafe as well. That's maybe the way of creating a dialogue between the architect and the people using the city in a very broad way. So right now we have our silo project exhibited in the cafe, but actually soon the metro line here is opening, so we would like to show our ideas behind the two stations, which is opening up here soon. So actually people can go to this neighborhood, step out of the metro and go and have a coffee or a beer in the cafe, and actually see our thinking behind some of the actual design people are using in this specific neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty unique thing to do, to actually give people access to the thinking behind some of the spaces you actually just experience, which is, in a way, new urban design in a neighborhood emerging as well. But we want to, we have tons of ideas of different activities we want to do in the space as well. And then it's in general also just our entrance to the office, our reception. So we have people coming in buying books or posters or having informal meetings from other companies located here. People on maternity leave coming with their trolleys and just sitting with their babies. It's a new thing for us, but it's basically also just like a urban living room where you can go and hang out, which accidentally is also our reception or entrance to our office.
He believes that opening the cafe reflects the company's values in creating social spaces for the public, or as he puts it, a third dimension in the office.
For me, this is a little bit like taking your own medicine. We speak a lot in our work about activating the public realm to open up to the city and create amazing edge zone of a building, and how does buildings and architecture energize a certain place or a neighborhood. My idea with this cafe was actually, we speak a lot about it in many different projects, but why don't we do it ourselves? So it's a little bit taking your own medicine and saying, okay, we also need to embrace the city and open up and create a lively neighborhood by activating parts of our office to the city as well. So I would say it's not only talking about it, but actually doing it yourself. And I thought, okay, now we move here and we create our own office. We have, I think our office is 2,400 square meters. It's a big space, but it's super private space, basically. It's only for the people working here. So I actually wanted to kind of, okay, let's just do a tiny part of this, which is actually addressing the public as well. And where you can just go and have a coffee and meet us as architects and we can have a dialogue, but also where we can, where people working in the office, they have a very informal space to hang out or have a cozy meeting. It creates a third dimension in an office space, which is in a way very two-dimensional. People work, everybody knows each other, but now there's new faces every day and people are coming also because they're very interested in what we do, our work, and actually just getting a sense of what is actually architectural office, what is this about, how does it look, and what do we do.
After my chat with Dan, I stopped by a few locals enjoying their time off and sipping a coffee. I asked them what they thought about the project.
I think it's really cool. It's very low-key. It's good coffee.
I think it's super nice that you can get so close to an architecture company. I've never been inside one before, and it's pretty cool that that's available. And I agree with Nana that the coffee is really good.
Personally, also as a designer, I think it's a really nice place to be. And having a look at the books, also the products that they're selling, I think it's nice for that.
It's very nice that you have an opportunity to actually talk with the architects and the urban planners of the area without actually having a meeting, but it's more like in a casual way. It's a nice opportunity to connect. It's a good link between professionals and unprofessionals, like normal people.
So, whether it's for a morning croissant, a post-lunch coffee, or a well-deserved beer on a Friday evening, Cobe's innovative concept brings the often sheltered world of architecture studios straight into the everyday lives of Copenhagen locals, whose third place away from home and work is no longer a simple cafe, but a gateway into the Danish capital's ever-evolving architecture scene. For Monocle in Copenhagen, I'm Gabriele Lisanti.
Thanks to Gabriele Delisanti for that report from Copenhagen. And sadly, that's all we have time for today. Don't forget to subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, the imaginatively named On Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which is available on all self-respecting newsstands now. Monocle On Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.